part two of our series. Hopefully it'll be only three parts, called Family in Crisis, the reaction of the family of Yaakov and his sons to the crisis they found themselves in, which was brought about by the manipulation of Yosef. Left off with the situation as the brothers returned from Egypt, and of course they didn't know what danger they were confronting, other than that the leader, they didn't know it was Yosef of course, had accused them of being spies and had kept Shimon as a hostage in order to verify whether they were one family, which can only be done through bringing back Binyamin. And as we saw, when they came back, they knew that the Yaakov would confront them with the fact that one of the brothers was missing, and they needed to have some type of a excuse that would make it easier for Yaakov, reasonable for Yaakov, to part with Binyamin. They realized that it would not be easy to get Yaakov to part with Binyamin, so we analyzed the way they told over the story. And they told it over in a way to minimize the danger. They put a spin on the story, as we showed, attempting to let's use the word mislead Yaakov, because they felt they had no choice. If Yaakov understood the situation to be as dangerous as it was, there was no way that he would ever leave a Binyamin go with them. And as we saw, Yaakov did not respond until they began to unpack and they discovered the missing money, that all the monies had been returned, and they, together with Yaakov, they saw this. And we said that Yosef had actually planned it this way because he knew that the brothers would be very skillful in manipulating the situation, so he had to do this to undermine their credibility. And then Yaakov, upon seeing the money, realizes that there's something much more serious over here, and he lashes out at them and he says, "Oh, see, she called them." And in fact, he's really accusing them now. Nothing specific, because he even mentions Yosef. Yosef is not here. Shimon is not here. And now you're going to take Binyamin? Alai hayachulan, all this is upon me. In other words, he's not officially accusing them of anything, but he's saying that there's much more to this than what you're saying. And there's something wrong here, and he just refuses. Absolute refusal. Let's pick it up from there. What happens next? That's at the end of chapter 43, Pusik 37. So, in response to Yaakov, Yaakov refuses their request. Reuven immediately says, and Reuven said to his father, "You may kill my two sons if I do not bring him to you. Give him and trust him in my hands. Entrust him to me, and I will return him to you." So Reuven steps forth and makes a very dramatic offer to his father in order to get him to entrust Binyamin to him. And we have the response of Yaakov. And he said, "My son will not go down with you, for his brother is dead, died, and he has remained alone, and should there befall an accident to him on the road that he will take, then you'll bring me grieving, my old age. My old age will be brought down in a grieving state into the grave." Okay? Let's just pause. That's one segment. What's the problem over here? The answer of Yaakov I can deal with, makes sense. But what's astounding over here is the nature of this offer. What we're assuming now, that Reuven is not a crazy person, he's not a wild person. He's in the highest, we have to treat all of the individuals in the story as the type of people they are. They're all tzaddikim, they're all righteous people, but they're all exceedingly wise people. They're on the highest, they represent the highest level of Judaism, of Jewish knowledge, Jewish practice, Jewish belief. Now, it's gotta make sense. The offer doesn't make any sense at all. What kind of an offer is this? Was he serious? Was Reuven really serious? Under what system of morality, under what system of justice would such a thing make sense? It's one thing to be very zealous and to promise you'll do everything, and very often you could even reassure him that you're not going to leave any stone unturned, so you'll say you can take all of my possessions. I'll make out a check for all my money. So therefore, I know that if I make a mistake, I'm gonna. But how could he? Did he mean this seriously? Is there some system of justice over here? Does he have a right to do that? First of all, what right does he have to do this? He doesn't have. A parent doesn't have that type of control over his children to offer his children as hostages to be killed, and Yaakov would really kill him. Let's assume that he would go ahead and do everything possible, and then he could still fail. So then justice would demand that his own sons would be killed. The whole thing sounds crazy. It would sound crazy if ordinary people were to do it. In our country, the type of people we deal with every day, if somebody were to make such an offer, I'd say he's insane. But when we're dealing with people on the highest level, how can we understand it? That's a major problem, I believe. That's one of the problems. Of course, the answer of Yaakov does not pose a problem for me. But take a look at the pasuk more closely. Is there anything in that pasuk that does require a little bit of explanation? In general, I've been asked that question. Why is Yaakov so unconcerned about retrieving Shimon? Why? What about that issue? I would say in general, this calls for a bit of speculation. I think it makes sense though. Yaakov was just as concerned for Shimon as he was for Binyamin. However, I think the situation, there was nothing that led him to believe that the life of Shimon was in any kind of danger. Certainly not the story that the brothers had presented. The way the brothers had presented the story, it was just more or less a routine type of a interrogation, and Shimon was being, in fact, they did not even tell Yaakov that Shimon was in jail. I pointed out last week. They said that Shimon was with this leader that we had to deal with, the master of the land, the ruler. Now we said but the truth is that as far as they knew, he was in jail. They omitted that because they didn't want to excessively frighten Yaakov. So there was no reason for Yaakov to assume that he was in any danger. Now, since Yaakov believed that allowing Binyamin to go would place Binyamin in danger, it made perfect sense. It made perfect sense to, why should I subject Binyamin to danger in order to remove Shimon when I don't absolutely have to do so? You see? That's the way he thinks, and that makes perfect sense. You don't take unnecessary risks unless you have absolutely no choice. But if you do have choices, so then why subject him to the risk? Shimon's in that situation. Shimon is not facing any danger of being killed, because why would he be killed? He's just being held so that the leader of the land could verify the story. I'm sorry, no. Binyamin's afraid of allowing him to go on the trip. There's a danger in the trip, in the journey. That's what he's saying. I'm sorry? I'm sorry? Okay, that we'll soon see. Obviously, he had different standards for the safety of Binyamin than from the other brothers. That's true. That is true. What Eliza is saying would go to a certain degree to answer Lori's question, is that he's concerned not just about the actual voyage through the Sinai, they had to traverse the Sinai, but the whole situation of being in Egypt. They're strangers in a foreign land. It's a whole situation of danger. But I think like this, why does he have to go? Now, this is the question that I had intended for Pasuk Lamed Ches. What seems to me to be superfluous is the wording, Ki Achiv Meis, Uhu Levado Nishar. The substance of Yaakov's answer, it is a response, although he doesn't mention anything about killing the two sons, as Tamar points out, but the basic response is refusal. My son will not go down with you. Now, Ki Achiv Meis, Uhu Levado Nishar, because his brother died, and he remained alone, etc., that seems quite superfluous. I think all the brothers are fully aware of that. I don't think that anybody needed to know that his brother had died. Well, of course, they know the truth that he didn't die, but I mean, in terms of Yaakov's framework, he died. So, as far as Yaakov knows, the brothers know all this. What is he telling them? That his brother died, and he remained alone. This would make sense if he's speaking to a stranger, but he's speaking to the very people who know the same thing he knows. So it's quite superfluous. What does he have to mention that? Okay? That's the question. Okay, what happens next? So Yaakov now has arrived at a decision. He's paskin the Shiloh. That's his policy. I'm not sending my son. Now we go into chapter 43. And what is the Pasuk Aleph? V'harav kaved ba'aretz. And the famine became extremely powerful in the land. Okay? Of course that's necessary. That's the transition. Something happens. Yaakov makes a plan, but as we know, he's not going to stick with this position for very long. And v'harav kaved ba'aretz is a very important factor. And let me read the next series of psukim. You tell me what's strange. So what happened was when they finished eating the food that they had brought from Egypt, so now they use up all their supplies. So their father said to them, return and bring back some food. And Yehuda says to him, saying, the man testified. It means he warned. He said in very, very exact terms, saying, do not see my face without your younger brother. If you are prepared to send our brother with us, we'll go down and we'll bring you back some food. But if you don't want to send, if you are not prepared to send, we won't go down. Because the man said to us, do not see my face without your younger brother. And Yaakov then replies, why did you do me evil to tell the man that you have another brother? Let's pause over there. What's astoundingly difficult about this whole dialogue problem? The problem over here is the rebuke. Suddenly he rebukes them for telling the man that they have a younger brother. Isn't it a little bit late in the game? That's a little bit inappropriate. That should have taken place before. When should he have given them that rebuke? When they first came back, they already told him that they told the man. If you go back to 42, 32, that's when they said that they told the man there were 12 brothers, the sons of one man, and one is not with us. That's a reference to Yosef. And Va'katan Hayom Esavinu Bi'eretz Kanaan. They gave that piece of information, which gave him the ability then to make this demand. And Yaakov did not rebuke them. At that point, he should have rebuked them. Why did you tell him all this? Suddenly, he's going back to the old issue. Okay, but that's the question. But there's a more fundamental question in this part. Yes? Yehuda's like explained to him, what happened to Yaakov? Yaakov knew the deal.
Yeah.
That's why he said, Lo Yered B'nei Machem. He already answered. He already passed in the Shal. He's not going back. Didn't he know that there's no way we can go back there unless we verify that we're not spies? And the only way we could do so is by bringing Binyamin. Yaakov is acting now, the food runs out, there's no food left. Okay, fellas, go back to Egypt and get some food. And of course, he didn't tell them that he did not change his mind as far as Binyamin is concerned. And then Yehuda patiently, like he's patiently sitting down with someone who has trouble, you know, remembering, bad memory, and says, but the man, you know, like he's,
right.
I'm trying to explain to you, what's going on over here? Of course, Yehuda wasn't disrespectful, but this doesn't make any sense. Yaakov knew all this already. It's astounding. How could he just go to them and say, go and get food, after they've come back with the reports and he's found the monies and he's concerned and he's made a decision? Alright, if he changed his mind, fine. So you'll tell me that Yaakov changed his mind. But if he changed his mind, then he should say, I have no choice, take Binyamin and whatever. But he's not prepared. At this point in time, he's not prepared to give Binyamin. One second. What Yehuda is telling Yaakov now, do not see my face unless you bring down your brother. That's the truth. He's not making this up. No way. Whether you go back to the story, it's unnecessary now. Yosef was pretty clear from the story that Yosef accused them of being spies. He wasn't going to give them supplies. He locked them all up. Then he was going to let just one brother go. Okay, then he became generous. And he kept one brother behind. That's very clear. If it's not stated there directly, we can infer it from here. Like the Ramban says, sometimes the Torah reveals things in one place, it doesn't reveal it in a different place, and you have to put it together. There's no question that what Yehuda is saying is the absolute truth. Because if it was possible to get some food without bringing Binyamin, then he would have been fine. He would have gone down and bought food. That's for sure the truth. The only thing is, why did Yaakov know that? Of course, I already also mentioned that Yaakov a rebuke. Why'd you do me evil by telling him that you had another brother? The question is a good question, but as we said, it's a little bit late. It's out of context. Why didn't he ask them that before? Or why didn't he rebuke them that way before? He tickled, then they answer. Take a look at their answer. They said, the man interrogated, asked us about ourselves and about our birthplace, saying, is your father still alive? Do you have a brother? And we answered him in accordance with these words. How were we to know? Were we to know that he would say, bring down our brother? Of course, what's difficult about their answer? What's difficult about their answer is that they don't answer the question. They just restate what they did. But his question was why? They just say, the man asked and we answered. Of course we know that. But his question was, why did you give away the information? State the question. The question is still a question. When Yaakov asked them that, he meant like this. You have to use seichel. That's why you see, Eliza, that everything involved in this required tremendous wisdom. And he assumed that they had this wisdom. His basic question was, and we learn a lot of lessons from this parsha have tremendous application to our own situations, as you will see. He was saying, the general rule is, don't volunteer information that you don't have to unless you absolutely have to. Whenever you're dealing with a situation where there's any uncertainty until and unless, well, you're totally confident about the other individual. You have total confidence, total security. You don't give away information. When you're dealing in a situation with strangers, people that you do not know, you don't tell anything more than you absolutely have to. That's a very important lesson to learn in life, and people get into all kinds of problems every day because they go ahead and do so. They have this emotion. You know, you meet someone, this, that, you may be lost, whatever, and because you want to curry favor with the person, you're trying to evoke a certain emotion, so you try, you know, you start telling them things about yourself, and then of course they will act in a very sympathetic way. But you have no way of knowing who they are and what they are and how this information can be used against you. You don't realize, but you see this happening all the time. This is just the thought occurred to me. It's an interesting thing. You see it if you read the newspapers. You see in our own time how many people have really lost out in life. I was just thinking about over the last 10 or 15 years, the number of people who were appointed to the Supreme Court, and then it turned out that they had to withdraw because it turned out that they, in earlier days, they had done things that weren't quite either smoking drugs or this or that. You know, perhaps it's considered minor, but I'm always wondering, how did this information come out? This information. Well, usually, it led me to a certain hypothesis that who would you say are a person's two worst enemies? Who would you say are a person's two worst enemies? His own mouth and his best friend. Because it's an ironic thing, and most, how do these people know? Who was it? What was that? Ginsburg, one of the Jewish fellows, was nominated. I don't know, but it always turns out that somebody leaks it to the press that 20 years ago, whatever the case, at a party he smoked some marijuana. So why did he have to come forth now? This was it's only through his friends. So a person, or he himself, usually when a person does something, pulls off some type of an exploit, whatever it may be, he's got to brag about it. It's his own mouth. He's got to be very careful. And of course, when he does so, he has total confidence that the person would never use this information against him. That's a mistaken notion of human nature. You've got to be very, very careful. Many people who you think are your friends, yeah, they are your friends, they're not really your friends. They're your friends in a certain context, you see, in a certain situation. When things are going in a certain level, all of a sudden, all of your true friends, you could find out if you should suddenly become extremely successful at something. If something should happen to you which would occasion significant envy, and then you'll find out if you really have friends or not. True friends would rejoice. True friends would rejoice and would not seek to do anything to harm you. You got to be extremely careful. In general, his criticism was, why did you have to tell? You don't know who this man is. You don't know what the situation is. So the certain amount of information you have to give, the less the better. But certainly don't give more information. That's his criticism. That's why I say they didn't address that in the answer. They just said, they're talking like naive people. Well, the man is, so he answered. I mean, what kind of an answer is that? Yaakov, of course Yaakov knew that. But you don't... Oh, you mean you have to tell the... Oh, is that the point, that you always have to tell the full truth? No. You don't have to tell the truth all the time. Right? You know, I said that last week. You know the expression. You know, I'm going to say it in English this week. It loses a lot. You know. You're not allowed to lie, but you don't have to tell the truth. There's a lot of truth in that. And sometimes you are allowed to lie. But the point is that this is an important lesson. Be very careful. And don't be so trusting. And you'll find even amongst people that you trust, that you still don't tell everything. There's always some secrets. Now Yehuda steps forth. This is very moving, by the way, in terms of, it's not, you know, most of the stories of the Torah really don't hit you on an emotional level. They're not, you know, they're intended to convey ideas. This is, of course, conveying tremendous ideas, but it's a very moving story. Now Yehuda steps forth. See, remember, we're going to contrast the response of Yehuda to the response of Reuven. And Yehuda already has been sort of moving into the position of assuming leadership role. And he says to his father, send the lad with me, and we'll get up and we'll go, and we'll live and not die. Us, also you, also our children. So Lisa, that goes a little bit to answering your question. You see, because the rest he refers to as Tapenu, our children. We have the responsibility. No one else can do this for us. That's basically what Yehuda's saying. Okay, so what's the offer, though? You know, why should I trust you? Anochi Erevenu, I will guarantee him. Now, the term Arev, that's Arev. An Arev is a guarantor. That is the same term that's used for a cosigner. In fact, the Gemara learns that halachas from here. You know, a cosigner has a halachic responsibility. It means that if, you know, you want to borrow money from someone, and that person is not sure that you can pay back, so you get a cosigner. The cosigner then becomes legally obligated. That's an arev. An arev would be that if you can't pay the loan, if I've agreed, then I have the chiyuv, the same chiyuv. Now I now have the chiyuv to pay. So he's saying, I will be the guarantor. From my hands will you seek him. If I don't bring him back to you and cause him to stand in front of you, that means bring him back in full health. That's what Rashi points out, not dead. Bring him back alive. Then I'll be a sinner unto you all the days. V'chatasi lecha kol yom, I'll be a sinner unto you all the days. And Rashi says that all the days over here is a reference to the world to come. All the days. Not only will I be a sinner to you in this world, but in the world to come. That's the offer of Yehuda. He has one more thing to say. For had we not tarried, I could have been back twice already. I had been up and back two times already. Okay. But what's the... What's the difficulty about his offer? Of this, if you compare the two offers, we had a difficulty with the offer of Reuven, but I think it does contain one advantage over the offer of Yehuda. What's Yehuda's offer? What? There's nothing concrete. What's he offering? I will guarantee him. What kind of... Well, it's a guarantor. Yeah, money. You're talking about money, so I understand. I'm stepping forward. Lend him the money. If he can't pay it back, I'll pay it back. Okay, so now I've got something. What's the guarantee? What am I going to give you? I'll be a sinner. If that's very nice. So you'll be a sinner unto me all the days. So what kind of guarantee is that? What right does he have to be to say that he's a guarantor? What kind of a guarantor? That's a nice thing to say. You know, a lot of times people get up. You know, when the meetings and shuls and everything has to be done. Yeah, go ahead and do it. You know, I guarantee. You guarantee. What do you mean you guarantee? I guarantee it'll be successful. Are you prepared to put your money behind that guarantee? That's something else. I guarantee you. You notice how quick people are to guarantee. Everybody's definitely prepared to guarantee. As long as it doesn't cost anything, total guarantee. All Rashi says is, V'chatas l'cha kol yamim, and I will be a sinner unto you all the days, la'olam haba. Which could mean, as you put it, that I'll give up, if you want to translate it that way, I'll give it up, my own haba. So Aliza is asking, what do you mean? A person is, it's not your decision. They don't ask you, I don't think. After this world, they don't ask you, assuming you're eligible, do you want own haba or not? I don't know that it's left to one's choice. Anyways, you don't just give up your own haba. Now, as far as Yudah is concerned, I'm not sure what's the point of that. How does that add to the argument? How does that strengthen the argument? What, is he criticizing his father? Is it a little bit of bravado over here? For had we not tarried, I would have been back twice already? How does that fit in? But all right, that doesn't bother me so much. The key issue is on test. And now, we have the next phase. We see Yaakov agrees. As a result of the two factors, what are the two factors which bring about a change? And this is not easy, because when a man like Yaakov makes a decision, it's firm. He's not about to change it. There are two factors that cause him to bring about the change. What are the two factors? The Rav. The Rav was very, very powerful in the land, and apparently the offer of Yehuda. So then Yaakov says, now that's the last thing we have to analyze. So he says, in Cain Apho, if that's the case, if I'm forced to, if I have no choice, Apho, Rashi says. Apho, what's here? I have to look into the situation. If this is the case, then now I have to really look into the situation. And I have to come up with a plan. So here's my plan. Zosasu, this is what I want you to do. Take from the exalted fruits of the land. That is, Rashi says, the land, which is Zimras, is from the word Zemer, saying the fruits of the land that that people praise, that people sing about, in your vessels, and bring a present down to the man, a bit of honey and a bit of wax, a bit of balsam, pistachios and cashews, different types of treats, I suppose, delicacies, interesting nechos utsrivalot, that the caravan that brought Yosef down was carrying nechos and three pleasant smelling spices and food. Okay, that's this. So now the Torah reveals to us the strategy. So suddenly Yaakov has done a 180-degree turn from someone who didn't even want to get involved in the problem to begin with. Now he's totally involved. He's taking complete command. He's in complete command and he's dictating the entire strategy. So what's the strategy? Gift. We're familiar with that already. That seems to be the strategy of Yaakov whenever he confronts a hostile situation. Then he says in Yud Beis, V'chesef mishnek chubiyedchem. Take double the amount of money. Why double the amount of money? Rashi says, Pi shnayim karishon. Twice the amount that you took the first time. Kachubiyedchem, take in your hand. Rashi says, Lishbor ochel, to purchase food. Shemahu karasha. Maybe the prices have gone up. Okay. Inflation. No, not inflation. Supply and demand. Okay. Twice the amount of money. Kesef Mishnah. Wait on second. Now, the Esa Kesef Amusha. Now the return money. Bear in mind that we entered into this whole thing because we were concerned about that whole issue of the return money. What about the return money? The money you found in your sacks. The return money, which was returned in your sacks, bring it back in your hand. Ulai Mishkehu. Perhaps it's a mistake. Perhaps it's a mistake. And then, of course, he completes it with... Now, I guess he saves the most difficult part for last. And take your brother. The objective of everything that Yosef had engineered was for this very moment. To bring Yaakov to a situation where he would have to be willing to part, to break his excessive attachment to Yosef / Binyamin. And take your brother, of course that's Binyamin, doesn't even mention him by name, and get up and return to the man. And may God place your mercy before the man. And let him send your other brother, that's a reference to Shimon, and Binyamin. And me, Kasher Shacholti Shacholti. If I am to be bereft, then I'll be bereft. Just like I've been bereft of Yosef, Kasher Shacholti Mi Yosef, just as I've been bereft of Yosef, so too, I'm prepared to be bereft of Binyamin. That ends this segment. Very moving. Still approach this segment. What bothered me was something else. Let me just tell you that, because in terms of methodology. What bothered me was, why is the Torah see fit to recount the instructions of Yaakov? They seem more or less to be straightforward, they don't seem to be, on the surface anyways. The Torah isn't, it's not a history book, it doesn't record all the details. I assume that if you were in that position, you had to work out, the plans are pretty straightforward. What's he telling them? That's so unusual. That would reflect some insight. There must be some insight here, which is not visible on the surface. So I believe that it's not so simple. That Yaakov took over complete control of the strategy of the plan, and if we study it carefully, you'll see that each one of them reflects tremendous wisdom, and we can learn a great deal from them. Okay? And I'll take up the question you raised about the gift. I have a different problem with the gift, though. In the last part of Yaakov, one thing, though, does remain constant. There is a parallel between his preparation for the confrontation over here and for the confrontation with Esau. He plans, there's planning and prayer. Preparation and prayer. There are two elements. Well, gifts also. Gift, preparation, and prayer. The only thing that's lacking is the element of preparing for war, which obviously doesn't have any. There's no way you can fight a war yet. When the brothers first came back and they presented the story, and he saw Shimon was missing, so as we said, Yaakov, because of the return money, Yaakov decided there was something amiss, that there was some foul play, and therefore he arrived at a decision. The decision was, I'm not going to send my son with you. Now, Yaakov was not the kind of person that made decisions one day and changed them the next, because everything was based upon careful reasoning. And therefore, that decision remained in effect as long as the situation, it was based upon a certain assumption of the reality. It meant to say, was based upon the assumption of certain universals. It was based upon the reality of the moment. The reality of the moment is that we have food. And he had no way of knowing how long the famine would last. Therefore, as long as that is the reality, I'm not going to subject him to any kind of danger. That's why the pasuk says, "V'harav kaved bi'aretz." Reality has a way of asserting itself. The reality changed. Had this not happened, then Yaakov would have stuck with his decision. The decision presupposed a certain reality. Once that reality changed, Yaakov had no option. He now had to do something to acquire more food. Of course, the question now, I'm setting it up for Marion, the question then is, so he tells the sons, go down and get some more food. And it seems as though he totally forgot about the necessity of relinquishing Binyamin. Now, answer that question, please. The reason why Yaakov tells them to go back to Egypt and does not mention anything about Binyamin, as though he's not even aware of that requirement, is very simple. They never told him that the situation was that serious. Go back to what they said. They said, that this is a procedure which is being instituted in order to give us trading rights to traverse the land, and if we comply with it, then we'll have a very good position. But did they ever mention to him that we can't even go back? Not even answering, just stay on the border and have somebody go over the border and bring back some food, that's how serious the situation is? That the man will not even deal with us? That he won't even see us? That they never told Yaakov. That's why he says, go back and get a little bit of food. Go back and get a minimal amount just to keep us going for a while longer. Maybe by that time the famine will be over. That's all Yaakov knew. Because the brothers had deliberately withheld from Yaakov the seriousness of the situation. That makes perfect sense. That's why Yaakov doesn't know this. That's why Yaakov says, go back and get some food. Some food. I'm not asking you to go into the land and travel throughout the entire land and make a big expedition, because that I realize you can't do without Binyamin, and I'm not going to send Binyamin. But go back and get some food. That's when Yehuda sits down and has a little talk with him. Abba, it's not the way you think it is. He's breaking something new to him. Yaakov, the information is coming to Yaakov in stages, in phases. He's being faced with the enormity of the problem, of the reality that he's facing. That's why he says it in both ways. He has to spell it out so that there's no room for doubt anymore. It's not redundant. Ha'ed, he's using the strongest terms. We're not exaggerating, Father. The man testified. The man spoke very, very sincerely. There's no question about what he meant. Do not see my face. If you send him, then we'll go. If you don't send him, he's forcing him into that situation which Yaakov wanted to avoid. There's absolutely no choice. Everything will stand or fall upon your decision. If you are prepared to part with Binyamin, we will go. If you're not, we can't bring back anything. We can't go back there. We'll make it worse if we go back there. We can't violate the man's order. That is the first time that Yaakov discovers how serious and how dangerous the situation really is. To give them freedom, passport, to go travel throughout the land, to give them a green card or whatever, I don't know, whatever it would be, that they couldn't get. But they could stand at the borders and just make an order. In other words, Yosef is afraid they may be spies. So therefore he won't let them travel around the land. But if they're not going to travel around the land, they're not even going to enter. But just stay on the other side of the border and send a messenger to pick up some food. That's not spying. In other words, and just get whatever is available at the border. Why should he be concerned about that? That does not pose a danger to the land of Egypt. You see? So then the Yaakov thought that would be okay. What's the problem? The answer is that it's worse than that. In other words, if it's a routine type of a thing, and basically a protection for the country, so then Yaakov's position makes sense. But if it's more than that, we're subject to some kind of an accusation, we're caught up in something over here, it's much more serious than that. Then Yosef, don't even come down to see me. That's the reality. The reality was that it might be just a routine interrogation, we don't know. But the brothers knew very well. Why were the brothers afraid when they discovered the return money? This might be something worse. We might be in for some big catastrophe. He may be setting us up to destroy us, scapegoats, whatever the case may be. That's the reality. If that's the case, then we can't even return. That was the real condition. That's what Yaakov is facing right now. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm not asking you to go down and empty the place out. Just get us a little food. That can't be such a big deal. Okay, let's proceed. Let's continue. I'll explain the offer of Reuven because I wanted to. And Yaakov's reply. Because I wanted to explain it in contrast to the offer of Yehuda, which was accepted. Okay. We had a question on the answer of Reuven. We're going to take up the answer of Reuven. And we had a question on the answer of Yehuda. And we want to understand the difference between the two and why it is that Yaakov accepted the answer of Yehuda. Before we take that up, let's answer another question now. I'm sorry. The order is very important. Pasuk Vav is a turning point. In Pasuk Vav, Yaakov rebukes them and says, "Why did you do me evil?" To tell the man that you have another brother. Now my question was, why is he rebuking them now? Why didn't he rebuke them at the very beginning for that? Okay? This is not a rebuke. This is not a rebuke. At this point in time, Yaakov is beginning to deal with the situation. He's taking over. It's not a rebuke. Until this time, Yaakov did not involve himself in idle questioning, in idle speculation. Yaakov was involved in important matters, in metaphysical matters, in deep thought. Of course he dealt with the world of reality, as we will see. But once he made, his reaction to their request was, "Osi shikaltem." That's it. There's no need for me to ask you all these questions. I'm rejecting your proposal. That's it. Now, however, Yaakov sees that he's going to have to get involved. In order for Yaakov to get involved, he's going to have to come up with a plan. Now I have to have information. I have to know what's going on. At this point in time, Yaakov is already beginning to consider the possibility that he will let them go back. If so, he's going to have to come up with a plan. If so, I have to know what was motivating you. Why'd you tell him? What's the situation? Before I can make my decision, I've got to have this information. So the Lama Hari Osem Li is not a rebuke, it's a question. Why did you do something which was harmful to me, which was negative? Meaning, as I said before, you don't give away information unless you have to. And here you see, by doing so, you put me in a bad situation. I have to understand why you did it, because I can't formulate my response unless I understand what was motivating you. Yaakov, for the first time, is taking an active involvement in the investigation. That's why the pasuk makes perfect sense over here. What was the answer of the brothers? The answer of the brothers is not apparent from the surface, because they say, well, the man asked us, and so we told him, yeah, but that doesn't answer the question. His point was, you don't give away information. So you don't tell him about the brother. You don't know him the truth. There's no obligation to tell him everything and anything about your life. It's none of his business. Why do you have to tell him? The answer was that we were dealing with a very tough individual. He's a very shrewd person. He's a very tough interrogator. And the whole accusation was based upon the fact that we were 10 people who came in from 10 different places. He subjected us to an intense interrogation. We claimed our only defense was that we're all members of one family. Now, once we have to tell him that. Now, once we told him that, he started to ask more questions about the family. At that point in time, we faced a very serious question. Should we tell him the truth? We did think about this. Or should we make up a lie? And we decided to tell him the truth. And the reason, why was it smarter, politically, why was it smarter to tell the truth? Because how are we to know? It's much more dangerous and risky. Like somebody said, if you're lying, sometimes you get into a situation, you get caught, but you lie. If you're lying, you have to have a very good memory. You have to have an excellent memory. If you're telling the truth, you don't have to have a good memory. Because you're telling the truth. Even if you forget the detail, you get the detail. But if you're lying and you make one mistake, you're going to get killed. So in this situation, we have 10 individuals. We have a tough guy. If we lie, we have to make up a lie. Then he can get us each one separately. And we have to get together and all have to be in sync. One slip up and we're finished. But if we tell the truth, what do we have to worry about? How are we supposed to know where this man is going? We have no idea where he's going. In the situation as it unfolded to us, this was the most logical course. The other way, to tell him a lie, would be creating the problem. By telling him the truth, he won't be able to say we're liars, and hopefully everything will be okay. That was a very good explanation. That was the answer. And that did restore a certain amount of confidence to Yaakov, that they weren't acting recklessly and crazily. That was the smartest thing to do. In other words, principle number one in life is, don't give away information to strangers. And how you define a stranger should also be revised in your mind. But don't give away information. Point number two, if you are in a situation and you do have to give away something, if possible, try to stick with the truth. The truth is easier. It's easier. And because when you lie, you've got to change about 20 other facts that go along with it. There's a lot of changes. And one split, you don't see the contradiction. But if you're up against a tough opponent, he'll see the contradiction and you'll get caught. In that situation, they were acting correctly. So Yaakov was satisfied on that count. Now Yehuda steps forward. Yehuda bided his time. There's a difference between the response of Yehuda and the response of Reuven, even insofar as the timing is concerned. Rashi points out, with regard to the response of Yehuda, what does the pasuk say? And the famine was very powerful in the land. On pasuk base, kashakilu lechol, when they had consumed all the food, Yehuda already was counseling his brothers. Yehuda already was assuming a position of command. He told his brothers, hamtinu lezaken, wait for the zaken, for the elderly one, achetikola pas min abayis, until there's no food left in the house. He knew his father. Yaakov is not going to budge. He's not subject to whims, to emotions, one day this, one day that. When he makes a decision, it's based upon the reality. Until the reality changes, don't talk to him. Wait. When there's no food left, then Yaakov is going to come back to the situation. He was biding his time. See, Reuven did not bide his time. Reuven was a bit impulsive over here. Let's get now to the analysis of the difference between the answer of Reuven and the answer of Yehuda. Let's take first the answer of Reuven. What we said is astounding. Is Reuven serious? Does he really mean that he's prepared? He's offering his son? And Yaakov would actually take him up on that? You can kill my son? Rashi says as follows, Lo yered b'ni imachem, my son will not go down with you. Lo kibel dvar shel Reuven, he did not accept the words of Reuven. Amar, he said, b'chor shota huzeh, this is a b'chor, a firstborn who is a fool. Hu omer lo hamis banav, he's saying kill his son. V'chi banav heim v'lo banai, are they his sons? They're not my sons, they're my sons too. Okay, it's true, but there's a point over here. And what? And if they weren't his sons? Does Rashi mean to say that Yaakov would have accepted the idea if they weren't his sons somehow? Let's assume somehow they weren't related to Yaakov. So he would accept it. The whole idea doesn't make sense. Even to the Torah Tamima. On the Pasuk, Lam and Zayin. Torah Tamima says, quotes a Gemara. Rav Tarfon, one of the great sages of the Talmud. So, of course, they had interesting ways of answering their students. They would answer with a quotation from a pasuk. When somebody would propose an idea which didn't make any sense, which was beautiful, rather. When somebody proposed a clear idea, and a beautiful idea, his answer would be Kafto v'ferach. Anybody know what that means? To the menorah. Which was beautiful, rather. When somebody proposed a clear idea and a beautiful idea, his answer would be Kafto v'ferach. Anybody know what that means? To the menorah. Kafto v'ferach, the spheres and with flowers. The menorah was made with Kafto v'ferach, with beautiful design. You know, the menorah was designed in a beautiful manner. So when somebody presented a beautiful idea, something which really was logical and made sense, his answer was Kafto v'ferach, beautiful, a work of art. Now, when somebody would propose a ridiculous idea, a nonsensical idea, an irrational idea, he'd express his disapproval by quoting from a different pasuk. What pasuk? Lo yered b'ni imachem, we said. My son will not go down with you. Interesting. Lo yered b'ni imachem. Now, isn't that interesting? It means to say, Reuven did not intend this literally. It was an expression of his emotion. He was so determined to show his father the extent of his desire to bring him back that I'm prepared. In other words, emotionally, I'm willing to go to that extent. I'm willing to have my own sons. I treat it in that way. But not literally. The words just came out without thinking. It was an impulsive kind of a thing. And that's why Yaakov said, Lo yered b'ni imachem. No. My son will not go down with you. And that's what Rashi means when he says, B'chor shoteh, that he's a fool. Doesn't he know that they're my sons as well? It means to say that, from the words that he uses, from the example that he uses, even if he doesn't mean it literally, but they're my sons too, you can see from that he's not thinking rationally. This is not a rational plan. Tremendous desire. The emotion is there. Tremendous dedication. But lo yered b'ni imachem. Sorry. Yehuda? Let's take a look at Yehuda. Yes? I guarantee you I'm going to ask you if you were in that situation. Once you fully he had two proposals, the proposal of Reuven, the proposal of Yehuda. Who would you entrust? Who would you entrust? We'll soon see, but let's hold that for a second. Yaakov used the opportunity to apprise them, to sober them up. He told them something. I mentioned this before. Ki achiv meis v'hu levado nishar v'aradatem esevasi. And my question was, they know this, what's he eating? Yaakov never told them this before. This confirms everything that we said, that we had proposed the idea that the special attachment that Yaakov had for Yosef had been transferred to Binyamin. And now he's telling them openly, for the first time, my relationship to Binyamin is different than my relationship to you. He never told them that. Ki achiv meis, his brother has died. That was my favorite son. And he's the only thing that I have left. I've transferred all my emotion to this one. And if he should die, he should die. But what about the rest of them? That question was asked before. If something should occur in the dark, well, what about if something occurs to somebody else? Now, the answer is, it's not the same. Somehow or other, I'll get over it. He's not being mean over here, but you've got to face this reality. You haven't faced this reality. That's the tshuva of the brothers is still in process. The tshuva of the brothers is to acknowledge that Yaakov has a right to have a favorite son. And the horatem esevasi, yes, if one of you, if something were to happen to Shimon or to anybody else, it would be a tremendous blow. It would be a tremendous blow, but it wouldn't produce, I'd get over it. Somehow or other. And I'd live. But if he goes, then I'm finished. Then I'm totally destroyed. And for the first time, he's telling you, have to accept that. You have to live with that. I don't have the same relationship with you that I have with Binyamin. And we know, of course, that Binyamin is a substitute for the Yosef. It's a very, very strong statement. There's no reason. Yaakov never really would have brought it up. We said it was a mistake to show favoritism to Yosef. He's paying for that mistake right now. It's another thing you learn. You pay for your mistakes. That's a very important thing. It's a very important thing to repeat. You pay for your mistakes. Of course, when you make them, you think that it's trivial, you can get around your mistakes. You always say, I know, I'll get around it, and I'll finesse it. V'harav kaved bi'aretz. The famine was very... That's telling you that reality has a way of asserting itself. You can get away temporarily with your mistakes, but you're going to pay for your mistakes. And now, Yaakov is paying for his mistake, but the brothers are going to pay for their mistake. And for the first time, they're getting it firsthand from Yaakov, Kiyoth of Meis. This is not the same situation. You fellas, I let take the risks of the journey. Him, I didn't. There's a special relationship over here. And you've got to accept it. Yes, let me continue. Yaakov has not done tshuva yet. Yaakov is still in that state of attachment to Binyamin. But it's perfectly correct that the brothers have to accept this reality. That's Yaakov's business. Whether this is good for Yaakov in terms of his soul or not, that's Yaakov's business. For the rest of the brothers, it's time for you to realize that it's none of your business, and I have a right to have a favorite son. And that there is a difference. Yehuda is really saying there's nothing. I'm guaranteeing, but there's only one guarantee I can give you. The only guarantee that's of any value. Externals are not really much of a guarantee. Because, bottom line, even if a person has a lot of money, that's just an emotion. And if the pressure becomes too much, too great, the dangers, so he'll give up his money. But there's one thing a person's not going to give up, and that's the perfection of the soul. I'm making a commitment which is based upon justice. My realization that the entire existence, the entire perfection of my soul is contingent upon whether I'll keep my word. I'm giving you my word, and that's my guarantee. I'm doing it. You see, to put it in a different way, that's why Kol HaYomim. What is Olam Haba? Olam Haba means the perfection of my soul. Now, a person can gain or lose Olam Haba. It's all dependent upon the perfection of the soul. Whether he acts in accordance with justice, that's a significant factor. I am making a commitment to you that I will do everything possible. He says, I don't think the guarantee would go like this. In other words, Yehuda didn't mean, because you asked, how can Yehuda make such a guarantee? An accident can occur. A bolt of lightning. Yehuda can do everything right, and on the way back, there could be a bolt of lightning, and Binyamin will die, and he's going to lose it all. No. He didn't mean that way. He meant to say that, insofar as it's humanly possible, I will carry out everything. And we see later on, to the extent that he would go to jail, take his place, and I'll become a slave for the rest of my life. Insofar as it's possible, if he has not come back due to any negligence upon my behalf,
And I'm prepared to give up my life. And he was prepared to give up his life, as we see later on. That was the promise. Then if I should fail in that, then that would be an injustice which would be destructive of my soul. That's all in my brought. Well, I mean, he can't predict. He's not making a deal with God. He can't predict because God will weigh... But it means that I realize how significant this will be in terms of my soul. This is such a solemn obligation that for me to fail, to fulfill it, would be the most serious injustice, and it would be destructive of my soul. That's all I can give you. In other words, put it in a different way, Yehuda didn't offer anything to Yaakov. Reuven made the offer. What was different between Reuven and Yaakov, in one sense, of course the other was impulsive, but Reuven said, I want to do it for you. Trust me, give it to me. Because I have this tremendous desire, this tremendous emotional desire to do it for you. Yehuda said, trust me, because I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for myself. Now, most people would prefer a Reuven. I know, that's when you deal with people, when you deal like a doctor, because you found a doctor. Which doctor do you like? He's so interested, he's so kind, he's so concerned, that he has that emotion. He's emotionally involved. The other doctor you go to is very aloof. He's really not that emotionally involved. Not that interested in you as a person. But he's a brilliant thinker, a brilliant scientist, a man of tremendous scientific integrity. And the other guy is different. He's got a personality. He's interested in my whole life. He asked about my family and this. He cares. He's a caring person. Now, the average individual, who do you go to? The one who cares. See, because that's what most people are impressed by. You're impressed by the emotion. You feel you can only trust somebody if there's an emotional connection. See? On the other hand, in reality, I would say it's just the opposite. The person I would trust, of course it's nice, nothing wrong with having an emotional connection, but a person of absolute integrity who's doing it not because of you, he's doing it because of his own perfection, his own commitment to integrity, without any emotion towards you, I prefer him than the person who has the emotion towards you, but's lacking in that high level of emotional integrity.
Yehuda wasn't talking about himself,
he was talking
for objective justice.
Well, that's himself. That's his soul. That's the most selfish thing you can do. That's selfish for objective justice, of course. That's his whole soul. My whole soul. The perfection of my soul demands that I do this. I'm not doing it for you because I have an emotional need to please you. Reuven had an emotional need to please his father. He's prepared to give everything for the... That's an emotion. If it's an emotion, then I can't trust you. Because emotions come and emotions go. And tomorrow you'll have a different emotion. But what can I trust? Someone who's reached a level of perfection such that he realizes that his own ultimate best interests are tied up with doing justice. Insofar as you can trust people at all, that's the only kind of person that you can really trust. Now, I think that there's two elements. First of all, he has to be convinced that Yehuda is the man in terms of justice. That is to say, I can trust this. That's the air of energy. I can trust your word. But also, I have to know if I can trust you. See, the attitude that a person has, that sense of... you know, sometimes people have the capacity to do something, but they're lacking in sufficient confidence. They're too pessimistic, they're too afraid, they're too insecure. I think that he wanted to convince, and Yaakov is looking at the situation now. Sometimes you're looking, you haven't been there. You're looking at a situation, all you see is the negatives. Sometimes when you hear somebody that's been there, he just paints a different picture. It's not as bleak as it looks to you. It's important to give him that sense of confidence. Don't get excessively pessimistic about the situation. If you're going to be too pessimistic about the situation, you won't be able to move. I've been there. I've seen the situation. So now he's expressing a certain sense of confidence. That's what Yaakov needs. Here's a man who's sober, who knows, who's talking sensibly, and he has that realistic sense of confidence that he could do the job. That's very important. You see that also in the case of David. When David had to convince Saul to let him go out against Goliath. And now every warrior, the mighty warriors, were afraid to take on Goliath. And here's this kid. And he was able to convince him that he had the capacity to do the job. He told him about the lion, the bear, and so forth. So Kilu Hefmanu is necessary to convey to Yaakov that you're dealing with an individual who is absolutely committed and has that sense of confidence that he could do the job. Now, the last thing I want to elucidate is that Yaakov now is totally transformed. He's accepted the necessity for sending the brothers back, and of course, that entails the need to separate from Binyamin. And the last thing we have to understand is the plan of Yaakov. And we said, see, Yaakov takes complete command. And we can learn very significant things from this. My question was that the instructions that he gives seems to be pretty routine. Makes sense. But never, so why is the Torah recorded? Now, the only way to break through and to try and see what ideas lie beneath it is to find the cracks, the questions. It's not, if you think about it carefully, it's not that simple. What stands out as being irrational in this plan? Yes? But it seems to me that there's a more fundamental question about the whole idea of the gift. In the situation with the confrontation with Esav, I understand the gift. And the gift was massive, was extremely bountiful. He was trying to win him over with a gift. But was a gift the appropriate approach in this situation? It's no sense whatsoever. I would say it's the worst possible thing you could do. If you get into a situation where your hope is that there's a misunderstanding. At this point in time, I mean, Yaakov is hoping that this is just a big misunderstanding. These things can happen. Now you, the best approach, what's the best approach? These things happen with the government, whatever. You can get into a situation where you're falsely accused of something because of misunderstanding, whatever the case may be. Let's use the illustration which I used. Let's say there's a misunderstanding with the IRS. You know, you've been accused of auditing, whatever the case is. And you know that you're in the right, that they're wrong. But the way you did things in a way that made it look bad. You didn't keep the proper record, whatever the case may be. But you know, so now you're in trouble. But you know that you're in a tough situation, but the facts are, the evidence are on your side, and it's just going to take some time to clarify, but in the end, you're going to be okay. Now, so what will I tell you to do? Get all your papers together, get your proofs, get your affidavits, be calm. You know, go through the steps, be courteous, answer all the questions, etc., etc. Now, what I tell you when you're going down to the IRS, and bring along a bottle of scotch for the guy that's going to do it as well. No, bad, very bad. I wouldn't recommend it. That's not the thing to do. The thing to do is, you're being accused, you're maintaining your innocence. Any type of an act of bribery would be counterproductive. Because first of all, it makes you look weak, makes you look guilty, and it also can be taken the wrong way. It's an insult to this individual. What are you doing? He's the leader of the land, and you're going to bring down some honey and this and that. It's an insult to the man that you're bribing him. What you're saying is that this is not really a system of justice, but everybody can be bribed over here. You got to be very careful when you bribe people. You got to do it very subtly. Believe me, there's a lot of it now in society. In governments, it happens all over the place. But it can't be blatant. It's got to be done very, very properly. So, that's what's really difficult about this whole idea. Now, in the case of Esav, I understand. The case of Esav was a gift, a tremendous gift. He wanted to share the wealth with him. Even there, he used discretion. Didn't make it appear like a bribe, but it was honor. He wanted to show honor. But that was a different situation. He wasn't being accused of anything by Esav. It wasn't defense against an accusation. So what is the point of a bribe over here? Binyamin is the answer. The way you're going to resolve this, there's only one way. It's through Binyamin. He's going to get Binyamin. He's going to interrogate him. The facts will be established. Now, if it's a setup, there's nothing we can do. Fine. But when we're operating on the hope that it's not a setup, and then it's just a misunderstanding. If it's a misunderstanding, clear it up. Don't start with bribe. But nevertheless, he does.
So this is what you said about bribing.
The key, what's the key word in the pasuk about the gift? What's the key word there? The key word is, there are two key words, ma'at, and zimras ha'aretz. It means to say like this is not a bribe.
Yaakov, it would seem that he's following the same strategy. He's not following the same strategy. Most people just adapt the strategy, they just follow. This is totally different. This was not intended to win him over. This was not, he knew clearly this would not, this was merely, Laurie said correctly, this is not a bribe. It's merely a display. It's an attempt, when you're dealing with someone, to set the proper tone on the emotional level. It's an attempt to show respect to the individual. Just by the mere fact that we're having a meeting with you, we're showing respect. These are what, in other words, people, when they go to certain places, they like to show, you know, what this land is noted for. Like people who smoke a Cuban cigar, that type of a thing. It's just a display of honor. That's why it's ma'at, very little. So it's not a problem. It answers that problem. That now there's a famine, how do we have... Because it's not a lot, it's just a small thing. It's, but what is it intended to show? Thoughtfulness. We're very thoughtful people. We're not criminals. Criminals, see, when the mafia, when criminals try and bribe, they try and give a lot. But there's no thoughtfulness. We're very thoughtful people. And we regard it as an honor just to meet with you. That shows the kind of people. We're thoughtful people, and we wanted to show some honor. So that can't be construed as a bribe. Because who is going to change it just because of a little honey and a little balsam? He's not going to, you see? But in the context of this, of a display of honor, now, Yaakov understood, every ruler is concerned about one thing, respect. You've got to show people their respect. And if you don't show them their respect, they get extremely upset, extremely agitated. This was just a show of respect, extremely important. A small gesture, just to put things in the proper perspective. Now, the next thing. Then he tells them to take twice the money. Kesef Mishya Kubiyotam. Twice the money. Now, what's the point? Why does the Baal ask the question? Why is... And the explanation seems to make sense. Maybe the, because maybe the price has gone up. That makes sense. You know, there's a famine and so forth, and supply and demand. The demand is getting greater, supply is getting shorter, so then the price is going to go up. So why does the Torah mean the brothers wouldn't have thought of that? And why, what is the lesson? Very important lesson over here. A very, very important lesson over here. You see something very interesting about this. It tells us something about the religious person. Most people think that the religious person is only dealing in the world of prayer and relying on God, and he has bitachon and all, he has faith and bitachon and all of that. This tells you something. Yaakov, did he have bitachon or didn't he? Yaakov didn't leave one stone unturned. You know the Yiddish expression, palazach nishat yesha, he was telling us. When Yaakov had to deal with the situation, he was involved in two areas, in prayer and preparation. It seems to me that when he was involved in preparation as if there was no prayer, as if there was no divine providence, everything you possibly can do, and then he prayed as if there was no preparation, as if there was nothing you could do. You have to be involved in both areas, but when you're involved in the area of preparation, there's a certain person, there's a certain attitude, certain religious people have. Don't worry, everything will work out for the best. Okay, we have to do a little bit, but what do you have to take a negative attitude? Why not? You see, rely upon, you know, God will take care of everything. Don't worry, why do you have to be pessimistic? A certain positive attitude, which is fueled by certain religious emotions. What he told them was, anticipate the worst. Most people don't want, people walk through life assuming, they go around with certain assumptions. Now, I found many, many times people come to me with problems. Certain things went wrong, business things didn't work out, or relationships didn't work out. I've, you know, gone through all these different types of problems with people. So then you start to inquire, well, what happened, this and that. Inevitably, well, it was circumstances. It didn't work out like I thought it would work out. Well, how do you think it would work out? Well, I thought it was going to be somewhere along the line. You know, they had a plan, they acted rationally, but then there are certain things that they didn't anticipate. Well, why didn't you anticipate it? I assume that if this was the case, I assume. You go, well, why did you assume that? Behind the, that's your problem. Your problem is you assume too much. Did you check it out? Well, why didn't you check it out? Well, I assume. Why would I think? Yeah. Because you're walking around with a certain fantasy of how life should be. Life should cater to your own reality, should cater to your own emotions. This is the way it should be, and I'm a good person, so why should, of course I'm planning and I'm doing everything, those other things, the reason why you didn't look into those things is because you didn't want to look into those things.
You could have looked. Now, of course, there are situations where, I'm not saying there's no situation where a person couldn't help it, but by and large, I found that when things are falling apart, those are the seams you have to look for. There's always a few things, brilliant plan, but it all rested upon certain assumptions, and they assumed, were they valid assumptions? No. Why did you follow along with it? Because you're walking through life with a certain imaginary thing that God is going to work it out, it's all going to work out, you know, happily ever after, it's going to work out for you. The Alchemist is telling him is, don't assume that reality is going to work out the way you want it to work out. Reality has a course of its own. Assume the worst. The average individual is not assuming that by the time he goes back, especially when it comes to money, taking a loan twice the amount, nobody wants to pay more money, everybody's looking for a bargain. Yaakov told him to anticipate the worst. And put yourself into a different framework. Don't go around with any assumptions. And that's the idea of the chesef mishne kechu b'yetchem. So Yaakov, for all his faith, all of his emunah, did not allow that emunah to presuppose that reality would work out in accordance with his particular needs. He treated reality as though there were no special protection for him. Even a person like Yaakov Avinu did not leave any stone unturned. Of course, the last part, Kesef Mishteh, V'yaza Kesef HaMushav, V'fiyam Tchosechem Teshiyu B'yedchem, V'lai Mishkehu. The last thing is, what to do about the money, the return money. What's the best policy? Should we just ignore it? Should we bring it back and just wait? If they ask for it, then we'll give it. What should we do about the return money? Yaakov says, bring it back, but yet, and don't wait for them to ask it. Go straight to them immediately. Why? Because if you wait for them to come after you, then they're on the offensive and you're on the defensive. Do not give them any opportunity to be on the offensive. You take the initiative. That even though it's the same idea of returning the money this way or that way, but the entire approach will be different. Go there immediately and deal with that money. Don't wait for them to come to you. Don't give them any opportunity to accuse you. Once they're in, even though you'll have the answer, doesn't matter. Right now they're accusing you. Don't give them time to start thinking, oh, how come they didn't bring the money back? Immediately resolve that. Get that out of the way. That's why that's an important part of the strategy. Those are the three elements. And then Yaakov finally, after the plan is worked out, V'yazachichem kochem. Now he turns to himself and prayer. He realizes that no matter how great the plan is, even though he's tried to address every detail, the ultimate disposition will be the will of God. So he prays the Kel Shakai. And what does he pray for? Interesting. All he's praying for is Rachman. That's all I can hope for. That we're dealing with someone that has compassion, and that he's not out to destroy us, but that he has his own agenda, he has his concerns, that there's a real misunderstanding over here. It's possible. But what about the return of the money? I'll show you next week how that could be very well explained. What Yaakov is saying is, it's possible. These things, mistakes are made. Even mistakes involving money. So take the money, and vani, which means to say that he's overcome. That's it. He realizes that reality has left him no choice. That he can no longer maintain his attachment. And that he's prepared, if this is what God demands of me, if this is what the situation requires, then I have the capacity to separate myself from Binyamin. And I will be prepared. This is Yaakov's moment of tshuva. This is Yaakov's moment of tshuva, when he withdraws the emotional energy of the attachment to Yosef, who is now in the form of Binyamin, and he redirects it. You'll see, he will be there. This is going to bring him to a higher level of perfection. The proof that this is the case, just let me conclude with this. The proof that this is the case, just 1 second, let me just... In Perek Mem Vav, in 46:29, Yosef's reunion with his father. Yosef harnessed his own chariot and he went to meet his father Yaakov in Goshen, and he appeared before him and he fell on his shoulders. that as Yosef fell on his shoulders, and he wept on his shoulders. Tremendous weeping. Very emotional reunion. But notice, the pasuk only speaks about one party doing the crying. Yosef was crying. What about Yaakov? That he cried on his shoulders. A great Lasha Od means Harbos Bechiah, tremendous cry. It says, Ava Yaakov, but Jacob, Lo Nafal Al Tavra Yosef. He didn't fall. He did not fall upon the shoulders of, he didn't embrace him, Lo Nashko, and he didn't kiss him. Did not have the same emotional reaction. Isn't that strange? Yosef is the one who had the excessive attachment. I mean, Yaakov was the one who had the excessive attachment. Yaakov was the one who said he'd go down mourning. He refused comfort. Wouldn't you imagine that the rabbi say you, what the rabbi say? Shayakari Yashma. He was involved in the Kriyashma. Which means to say that Yaakov was a changed person. As a result of the withdrawal of the energy to an emotional object, he redirected that energy towards achieving a higher level of his relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So when that reunion occurred, Yaakov was concerned. A person is always vulnerable. When he's overcome an emotion, he can be drawn back. Of course he loves Yosef, but now the love is a normal, appropriate love. Not an excessive love. So therefore he involved himself in the ideas of the Shema. Shema means metaphysical ideas about God's unity. He did it to protect himself. He did not want to fall back into that same emotional attachment.